every president that I'm aware of has wanted to get the hell out of the Middle East. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. My name is Elliot Cohen. I am Professor Emeritus at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Now, normally I would be joined by my partner in all things strategic, Eric Edelman, but he is finally taking some well-deserved vacation. But we have a wonderful guest for you who I'll be introducing in a moment. But first, so he doesn't have to be associated with this if he doesn't want to, I do think I should share our jackassery of the week, or actually two. And once again, it's our favorite whipping boy, Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, not the Secretary of War as he thinks he is, for two items. The first item is the Pentagon has been sifting the list of recognized religions for chaplaincy and those kinds of purposes. And they decided that the Mormons are not Christians. Now, being Jewish, you know, I'm not really an authority on the subject, but it does seem to me if it's called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that there's some sort of reasonable claim there to be Christians. So more seriously, what I think this probably reflects is an element of bigotry. I mean, there've long been some parts of the evangelical world in particular, I think, which really do not view Mormons as Christians. Now, needless to say, the Pentagon pulled this back after a bunch of Mormons got very, very excited on the subject. But it is something revealing, and it is part of a larger pattern of the intrusion of what I think I can only call sectarian kinds of beliefs into the Pentagon, and we've talked about some of those before. The other thing is, in many ways, even more serious, and that is at the recent observance of June 6th, the date, the anniversary of the landings at Omaha and Utah beaches during World War II, D-Day. Once again, Secretary Hegseth is there, and he spent a good bit of his speech denouncing European immigration policies. A good friend of ours, Bruno Tertre on X, said this is a desecration, and I fully understand what he has, what he meant by that. It is. It was totally inappropriate. And once again, you know, the Trump administration had an opportunity to be gracious, to reach out a hand to European allies, but above all to observe that anniversary with the solemnity and spirit with which it should be observed. And once again, they blew it. Well, with that, let me move on to introduce our guest, who I really am delighted to have with us. It's my very, very good friend, Kenneth Pollack. Ken is Vice President for Policy at the Middle East Institute. He's had an extraordinary career. He was a CIA analyst, very highly decorated for work, I believe, on the first Gulf War, which is when we met. He, despite my efforts to try to get him to get a PhD at Johns Hopkins SAIS, he went to MIT. But I don't bear grudges, at least not very much. He's had a terrific set of experiences in both the think tank world at Brookings, at the American Enterprise Institute. He served on the NSC staff as both director for Near Eastern and South Asian affairs, but also as director for Persian Gulf affairs. He, in addition to his classified work, he has written, by various counts, something on the order of 10 books, which is shocking. I'll just read some of the titles, and they're not just books, they are important books. Armies of Sand, The Past, Present, and Future of Arab Military Effectiveness. Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. That was published in 2013, and the issue is still with us 13 years later. A Path Out of the Desert, A Grand Strategy for America in the Middle East. And The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. That's 22 years ago in 2004, as well as a book called The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, a controversial book, as you might expect. But he's a wonderful friend and colleague. He is one of the country's foremost Middle East experts. He works with two highly regarded friends of mine from days in the State Department, Ambassador David Welch, Ambassador Stu Jones, at the Middle East Institute, and we have a lot to talk about. So, Ken, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you so much, Elliot. It is always a pleasure to be with you. And as a listener to Shield of the Republic, I am deeply honored to now be a guest.
Well, it's not going to be the last time. So before we get into substance, could you just say a little bit about what the Middle East Institute is? You know, it occurs to me that a lot of our listeners, but we have many listeners in Washington who are sort of familiar with the landscape of the think tanks, research institutes, and so forth. You know, many people have heard of Brookings and AI and CSAS, where I currently work, but there are many others, and MEI is one of the most important, but probably a little bit less known to people. So could you just say something about what MEI is and how you found yourself there?
Sure. So, MEI is, it's an interesting organization. It is an institution that has many parts. So there is a think tank. That's the part of it that I run. It is actually the biggest part. But we also have an arts and culture program with an art gallery. We have a wonderful library. I apologize. It is only about the Middle East. But if you're interested in books on the Middle East, all kinds of beautiful atlases, works of fiction, works of nonfiction, history, etc. Our library has it. We also have an educational program, although that's a little bit in abeyance right now. And we are the oldest U.S. think tank devoted solely to the Middle East. We were founded in 1946. And it's been through, as you can imagine, over that course of time, it's been through a variety of different iterations. And the way that I found myself there was that having more or less kind of played out its thread in a previous iteration, there was a decision among the leadership and the board to try to revitalize it, take the organization in a slightly different direction. Having built a Middle East center at the very least, the Brookings Institution with another old friend of ours, Martin Indyk, an experience that I found incredibly rewarding, very challenging, but also rewarding. I thought this was a great opportunity to, you know, take this organization, which had come a long way, and take it to the next step. And just briefly, the way that I would describe that is that we've set about trying to build a Middle East think tank really focused just on the Middle East, of the absolute highest quality, but one that is also very nonpartisan, right? I mean, I know this is an issue very close to your heart, to Eric's heart. You talk about it all the time on Shield of the Republic, that we've obviously become so partisan. And so many of the think tanks out there have really become nothing but advocacy organizations. And we decided to move in a different direction and to really go back to the idea of real expertise and real analysis that simply starts from the evidence, lays the analysis on top of that, and then formulates policy recommendations from that without any regard for the parties and where they may be on issues, but to just call balls and strikes. And we've been so far very happily rewarded that there does seem to be a real appetite in Washington, in the country, in the world, again, for that kind of expertise, for that kind of analysis on the Middle East, which, of course, I feel is what has been so lacking, at least over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, and I'll just say, I think you guys really have achieved that. And it's particularly hard on Middle Eastern issues where even in the best of times, all kinds of partisan feelings and attachments run very, very strong. And that you've been able to all have level heads, I mean, it really speaks to the leadership team that you've got. Okay, let's plunge right into substance. You have spent a large part of your career studying Iran and the conflict with Iran. I should have also pointed out in the introduction, you're also a very capable military analyst. You've been teaching defense analysis courses. You taught them, I believe, originally at the CIA, but then at Georgetown. Another recruitment failure on my part. And so what I'd like to do is let's begin with where you think we are in this war. Now, we're taping this on June 12th. There are, as there ever are with the Trump administration, contradictory signals about whether they're about to sign a deal or no, they're not about to sign a deal, or they're about to begin the most intensive wave of bombing since the bombing of Hanoi and Haiphong. I think let's set aside that for the moment. But I really would like your take on where you think both sides are in the war, and not just both sides, but a lot of other folks as well. So, kind of a quick situation report. What would you say?
So, I would describe it. I've been using this term, which again, you will know, it actually comes from a different part of strategic studies, but Bill Zartman came up with this term, the hurting stalemate. Now, again, he meant it about a different idea entirely, but I think it applies, right? Both sides are hurting. Both sides have an ability to cause the other pain. Neither side is really looking to escalate at this point in time. And obviously, different actors, I think, including President Trump, would very much like to de-escalate and, in fact, exit the war as best they can. But we've got ourselves caught in this set of circumstances. And again, we're in one of these, you know, classic coercive lockups where both sides have got their hands on the other's throat and are squeezing and trying to choke the life out of the other. And, you know, both are simultaneously hurting, but also believing that they're really close to causing the other side to capitulate. Right. And, you know, we've seen this any number of times in warfare. I know you've written about it in various books that you've written. And it's very, very difficult to know how close you actually are to that point where the other side is ready to give up, especially because so much of it is the psychological question of, do you believe your adversary is about to give up? Right. Because if the other guy is about to give up, let's hang on for just a little bit longer. And we've got an Iranian regime. Let's recognize this version of the Iranian regime is even more troublesome than the original version of the Iranian regime. Right? And that was, you know, nothing to write home about. But Ayatollah Khamenei, at the very least, was very conservative with a small c, right? Monstrous human being, but nonetheless, very conservative, very concerned about the United States, always looking to de-escalate in part because he always worried that the United States would escalate to regime change. Well, we escalated to regime change right at the get-go and we killed him and much of the other senior leadership. What we've got left immediately went to their normal contingency plan, which was shut down the Strait of Hormuz. That's what we always knew they would do if we tried to change the regime in earnest. And what they found, lo and behold, was that the United States wasn't going to immediately then come for the regime. In fact, we were going to back off. Right? Now, President Trump did respond, I think, the best way he could, which was with a blockade. But again, as you know extremely well, as many of your listeners know extremely well, blockades can be very effective. They take time. And it is very difficult to know exactly where we are in terms of inflicting the kind of pain on Iran that might cause them to give up, especially because what they're seeing from President Trump seems to have convinced them that he is desperate. And I think understandably, right? Again, I know you and Eric have talked about this. He has oscillated between these extreme threats and then a willingness to make, you know, very significant concessions to the Iranians, right? And so I think this is where we find ourselves. And the last point I'll make, Elliot, is that, you know, I hope that this blockade is working. I hope it does work because, of course, the alternative courses of action are so much worse. They're either really make massive concessions to the Iranians. And we should probably talk about them because we're starting to see some of this start to play out in terms of what the Iranians could expect from these kinds of concessions, or very significant escalation. I think well beyond what most people are thinking of. I'm just, you know, as you pointed out, a long-term observer of the Iranian regime. I am skeptical that bombing alone is going to cause this leadership in Tehran to make the kind of concessions that we need them to make to consider this war to ultimately have been successful.
You know, one of the things, and you and I have discussed this, that really strikes me is it is difficult to imagine two opposing sets of leaders who are further apart psychologically. I've written a book. I believe you've seen the manuscript. And you've commented on it, in which I say that the first strategic virtue is empathy. That, you know, the ability to get inside your enemy's head, not not to like them, not to sympathize with them, but just to imagine what it's like to be them at some level. And you're right. I mean, people always fail to do it. But here, I think that they are so far apart that, however, even if this is resolved with some sort of kick the can down the road, ceasefire, which is what people are talking about now, who knows if it'll happen. Even then, that is very far from being the end of the story. Let me ask you, also putting on your military analyst hat, was this a good idea badly executed, a bad idea badly executed, or good idea bad idea executed about as well as a reasonable person could have expected?
Whew, that's a tough one. So let me start here. One of the things that I've increasingly concluded, both from my own time in government and working in the policy world even after that, but also my study of history, including recent history, is that I increasingly believe, Elliot, that execution is far more important than the idea itself.
Completely agree with that.
Yeah,
totally agree.
I figured you would, right? This is Eisenhower's plans are nothing, but planning is everything, right? And it's not quite that the means justify the ends, but it absolutely is that a bad plan well executed is typically much better than a good plan badly executed. In fact, I'd say almost always. So from my perspective, the execution really is critical here. And, the original idea, I felt that the original idea was very problematic. It does seem to be the case that President Trump believed that he could remove the regime very quickly and very easily, and that this would either cause the Iranian people to overthrow it, or else some more pliable figure to emerge who would make the kind of deal that he wanted, or that he could simply claim credit for having gotten rid of this version of the regime. And that, I'd say that was always going to be a very, very long shot. I think it was a bad gamble to make. I will also say, it's hard to know exactly how much further beyond the accomplishments of what he calls the 12-day war this war is really going to take us, right? On the one hand, there's no question we have done a lot of damage to the Iranian military, particularly its Air Force and Navy, to the ballistic missile program, to a certain extent to the drone manufacturing program. We've done a great deal of damage to them. And my feeling is kind of, if you could end this war without making any concessions to the Iranians on the Strait of Hormuz, and, we also need to always keep in mind and on Iran's threat to be able to resume ballistic missile and drone strikes on the GCC states, if you could somehow magically do away with that, you could say we've done a lot of damage to the Iranians. And, given who the Iranians are, given the fact that, we should always remember this, they declare themselves our enemy and they act on it, right? And they've been doing it every single day for 47 years, right? We should never lose sight of that fact. And for those reasons, this damage is meaningful and positive in that sense. But the problem is that you can't just wish away the Strait of Hormuz and the threat to the GCC states. Just before I came on the air with you, I did check the news feeds, and there's a report out there, which is something that I was aware was going on and was expecting it all along, that the Emiratis have agreed to pay the Iranians somewhere between $10 and $20 billion.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, to enable their ships to get through. These conversations have been ongoing. The Iranians have been saying to all the Gulf states, you know that we can, A, not only interdict your shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, we can lob ballistic missiles and drones at you whenever we want to. And okay, let's say you intercept 99% of them. How many businesses are going to want to invest? How many tourists are going to show up? How much trade are you going to get if three or four times a week there is a big boom in the sky because a THAAD or a Patriot went up to have to intercept one of our drones and missiles, right? This is not acceptable for the Gulf states. And while they'd much prefer for the United States to win a military victory, if we're not going to, and it doesn't seem like we're there yet, they're going to wind up paying off the Iranians. And if the Iranians can wind up getting $80-100 billion a year from the Gulf states for a number of years, you know, for this is a country, let's remember, with about a $400 billion economy, that's an enormous amount of money. And so whatever damage we may have done to their Navy, their Air Force, their ballistic missile program, their drones, if they have access to those kinds of resources, they will rebuild them very, very quickly.
Yeah. Do you think if the war had been competently executed, which I mean, that it's not just a counterfactual, but it's particularly given this administration, which, as you know, I have a pretty dim view of. But let's say they had begun the blockade immediately. Let's say that they had focused military action from the get-go on securing the Strait of Hormuz, which they didn't really do. I mean, initially, a lot of the strikes were going lots of other places. If they had behaved rather differently to our NATO allies, who have certain assets which would be helpful, not just NATO, but some of our Pacific allies, if they had done more to kind of work with the Gulf states, could the outcome have been at all different? Or do you think that the odds that are created by geography and by the technology of ballistic missiles and drones is just such that an outcome like this is pretty much the inevitable one?
Well, let me start with a very important caveat that you've taught me over the years, which is, of course, wars are incredibly unpredictable. So we should always recognize that. That said, so I think all of that would have given us a better chance. What I would say, though, is I think it would have been much better off had we gone into this war with the notion that this was going to be mainly about forcing the Iranians to give us a better deal on the nukes, on the ballistic missiles. I think that the first mistake was the decision to try for regime change. And once you made that decision, pretty much everything else follows from it. Now, you know, if you had an administration that had been willing to put ground troops ashore on the northern littoral of the Persian Gulf, yes, add that to the mix, probably could have done better. That's certainly not Donald Trump. But the problem is that once you made the decision to try for regime change, the Iranians were going to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. Again, we've been collecting intelligence on them, working on this problem, reading their writings, listening to them, wargaming against this, planning against this since the early 1990s, right? We knew full well that if we tried, made a determined effort at regime change, that would be their move. And there as well, because of how we got into it, it was going to make reopening it even more difficult than it was always going to be. But you know, this is one of the good.
Well, no, I was just going to say, you know, on the regime change question, the thing that struck me about it was, there had been this really a popular uprising against the regime. The regime kills 10, 20, 30,000 people.
We don't know exactly.
We're not in a position to do much about it. We didn't do much about it. But the theory of the case, or the, if you will, the theory of victory, to use a more technical term, would be, well, we bomb them, we really kind of disrupt the IRGC, and then the people of Iran rise up and overthrow the regime. And I think just common sense would say, clearly you're, huge numbers of Iranians loathe this regime. The chance that they'd be willing to go out and do that again after tens of thousands of their fellow citizens have been butchered, plus whatever happens in the torture chambers and so on, that just doesn't make sense. And I mean, I don't know, you've got better contacts, I suspect, in the administration than I do. I mean, do you think anybody raised those issues, or you think they were just sort of sailing blind on with their prior assumptions?
My sense is that they weren't, or if they were, they were brushed aside. I mean, it does seem like the president just said he makes decisions based on his gut. And there's a lot of reporting out there, and my own sources tell me that it's essentially accurate that the vast majority of his most important foreign policy advisors were against the notion of regime change and going this big, right? And, again, to your point, Elliot, could you have gotten the Iranian people to do it? Perhaps, but, you know, I think what you would have had to have done is, instead of telling the Iranian people to go home and sit tight and let us blow up a bunch of stuff, and then later on you'll be able to do it, I think you would have had to take a much bloodier minded approach and call on the Iranian people to rise up immediately and then tell them we were going to provide air support. And I think it would have been an even bigger campaign, but, you know, between drones and look, we did have more or less air supremacy. I think we, you know, could have provided some degree of air support. At the very least, we could have, you know, hammered IRGC and law enforcement command and besiege elements as they came out to fight the people. I mean, you would effectively be using the Iranian people as the ground force.
Right. Exactly. Right. And we would be giving them air cover. So I don't think there's much point in speculating exactly what the outcome would be, because it's, like I said, it's Trump. You know, you don't know what he'll do tomorrow. And you also don't know to what extent the Iranians will also screw things up. Because Eric and I have argued a bit about this. I think on the one hand, Trump would like to escape this. On the other hand, there are some things he's not willing to do to escape it, I believe, but I may very well be wrong. But let's talk a little bit about the regime. So look, they did take a battering. They did lose an echelon of leadership. It's not clear who the single decision maker is. I guess we now think that Mojtaba is alive and functioning, but that wasn't certain for a while. There's General Vahidi, who seems to be the person people talk about most. But how solid is the regime, and what do you think is the long-term trajectory of the regime? I'll add just one other thought. You know, I think you're absolutely right when you say, look, this is a regime that's been at war with us for 47 years. It is in the DNA of the Islamic Republic, and don't let anybody try to convince you otherwise. And so this is in some ways a campaign in war that's been going on since 1979. The regime is, on the whole, one has to say, from the point of view of the people of Iran, a tremendous failure. I mean, it's impoverished the country in certain respects. It's causing a lot of misery. It hasn't dealt with a lot of basic problems. It's cut it off from the West, which actually many Iranians would like to be connected to. What is the trajectory of the regime, do you think, with or without whatever it is that the United States and Israel end up doing?
So I think that it is downward. But of course, whether it will just be kind of a long decline, or it's going to follow the tipping point, none of us knows, right? And of course, that's always the problem. And we hope it's going to follow the tipping point model, but you never know. You never know when the tipping point comes, if it will come. I think that if you were simply to step back and look at the history of North Korea, they've defied expectations over and over and over again. And, you know, we can point to examples, much better examples, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Assad regime. And then you can point to a North Korea and say, or Cuba and say, you know, how have these regimes survived? And of course, they've survived through force. And we should always remember that force, unfortunately, works, right? The one rule that social science has about revolutions is Theda Skocpol's famous observation that revolutions only succeed when the government loses either the willingness or the capacity to use force. And as long as they don't, they will stay in power. And so this, of course, is the great question about Iran. And it's one of those where, you know, boy, would I love to see it lose the capacity or the will to use force. From my perspective, again, Elliot, that's what I would have preferred. The Trump administration helped, the Biden administration, the Obama administration. And honestly, that was my feeling, you know, after the JCPOA, was that when it became clear that the Iranians were not going to take the JCPOA as an opportunity to have a better relationship with us, which is clearly what President Obama hoped, that we should have recognized that, okay, we just gave them the greatest opportunity that they were ever going to get, right? I'll put it this way. They were never going to get an American president more pro-Iranian than Barack Obama. who famously, you know, announced that this, or said, told Jeff Goldberg that the Saudis were going to have to learn to share the Middle East with Iran, right? Just an unbelievable statement from an American president. When the Iranians, you know,
and the last thing the Saudis want to hear, that's for
sure. Exactly, exactly. And when the Iranians, you know, threw that back in our faces, that should have been the moment that we recognized that we did have to start to develop an approach in terms of regime change with this regime. And again, that's where I still find myself. But again, one of the things I worry about with this agreement, whatever it's going to be, if there's going to be sanctions relief for the Iranians, if there are going to be massive side payments by the Gulf states to Iran, right? This is not going to help the cause of regime change. This is suddenly going to put lots, huge amounts of money in the hands of this leadership. And, you know, what we've seen all across the Middle East, at the very least, is that that kind of disposable income typically allows you to either buy off your opposition or buy the loyalty of your security forces, right? And those things go hand in hand, and they enable you to avoid coups and revolutions.
Now, that's a very important point, that you can buy the loyalty of your security forces, who, of course, know what's waiting for them if the regime falls. I mean, I think this was a point we had Stephen Kotkin, Russian historian, in, and was quite eloquent on that subject. Maybe let's step back a little bit. Every war, of course, reshuffles the deck in a variety of ways. Could you talk a little bit, what do you think are some of the long-term implications for the Gulf states? I would also say for Israel, and, you know, and you can go broader than that if you want to go Europe as well from this war, no matter, even if it ends in a somewhat inconclusive way, what do you think are going to be some of the things we should be observing and looking for?
Sure. And if we could, I'd love to talk about China as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some interesting stuff there. So for the Gulf states, and obviously, you know, I speak to folks in the Gulf all the time, including their leaders. And, you know, what's been interesting, Elliot, is let's be very clear. One, the Gulf states did not want the United States to do this, right? They adamantly opposed it. They tried to prevent us from doing it. We did it anyway. They were very pleased with the extent of American support that they've gotten during the war. And of course, for the Emirates, the Israeli support as well. But they're now very, very concerned about how this war is ending. I think, you know, the only way to think about it is that they are making their peace with what they think is going to be a very bad outcome for them. Because the truth is, and again, you had some bad press reporting on this a number of weeks ago. You know, there was a period of time where the Gulf states said, okay, we didn't want to get into this, but we're into it. The Iranians have attacked us. You Americans better finish them off. You proclaim regime change. Do not end this thing with them in power. Well, it's become clear that we're going to allow this regime to remain in power. They don't like it, but they're, you know, they've changed once again to, all right, we're going to have to make our peace with it. And so what you're seeing them do, as I've already suggested, is simultaneously a sense of, we're going to have to stay close to the Americans, because only the Americans can literally defend us against attack by the Iranians, right? And again, one of the reasons I want to talk about China is they've all figured out that China is not an alternative to the United States of America. And I think that's a very important outcome of both this war and the larger war that we've seen since October 7, 2023, at least not in the near term. China is not an alternative. But they've also come out of this with the sense that the United States is now the great rogue power. And they cannot trust us. We are not predictable. We are not reliable, at least in terms, you know, strategically, grand strategically. Sorry, I know you're not a fan of grand strategy, but that kind of a sense. And therefore, they're going to start looking for alternatives. The problem they have is right now, they don't have any good alternatives, but they are going to go looking for them. And that's going to very much color their thinking about us, about other countries. Again, part of what you're seeing is this very unhappy, very grudging, once again, Gulf reconciliation with Iran. We're not going to be rid of this regime. It is going to retain some capacity, both to interfere with shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and the ability to mount attacks on us, even if they're just, you know, harassing attacks, nonetheless, attacks that will have a severe impact on our economic and social stability and welfare moving forward. And if we can't get the Americans to eliminate that, then we're going to have to find some sort of reconciliation. And, you know, that's what you're seeing from them. So on the one end, as I said, the Emiratis are looking like they're going to pay, and that's what I expected, tens of billions of dollars to the Iranians. They and the Saudis are also contracting to buy huge numbers of drones of their own, right? And so it's both of these different things. The Gulf that's going to emerge, I think, is going to be a very different one, because I think in short order, you're going to find that they are not as dependent, or at least they don't feel as dependent as they once were on the United States. And, you know, who knows? We've never seen this, right? You know, for more than 100 years, the Gulf, or actually go back 500 years, the Gulf was dependent on the Turks, it was dependent on the British, and it was dependent on us. We've never really seen them as true free actors.
Yeah, well, and of course, at one point we thought that the, you know, pre-revolutionary Iran could be the security guarantor, and then even sort of toyed with Saudi Arabia, and that didn't work. I mean, I do think, I've commented in an earlier show that, that what a bonanza for the Ukrainian defense industry this war is going to turn out to be. And it seems to me that one of the things that would be logical to expect would be that, in addition to buying the Iranians off, which the Qataris seem particularly inclined to be to do, you know, they would invest in the ability not just to defend themselves better, you know, presumably using a lot of Ukrainian technology and some Israeli technology too, but the ability to really strike back and say, look, if you prevent our oil exports and if you attack our oil industry, we're going to do exactly the same thing to you, and we can probably do, you know, with big enough investment, do as much damage. I mean, that's, I think it's one of the things about a world in which ballistic missiles can do the things that they can do, that it's easier, I think, for them to even, you know, begin conceiving of the ability to say, look, we can inflict as much pain on you as you on us. Maybe not. I mean, maybe that won't actually work out that way, but it would seem to me a reasonable investment on their part. You've talked about external actors. Well, I want you to talk about one more. Talk about Israel. Because, you know, one thing that struck me in the commentary about the war is we've talked about this as if it was a war just between the United States and Iran, when actually the Israelis carried about half the load of the bombing, and actually a lot more of the load of the bombing in the 12-day war. And they're clearly prepared to do it again. I mean, if at some level, what's your take on all that?
Sure. And again, I do want to come to China, because I think there's something interesting about the Chinese worth talking about. So again, a lot coming out of this from Israel. As far as, you know, the rest of the region is concerned, and my sense is Israelis too, and I know you speak to Israelis as frequently as I do, there is a real sense of Israel as the regional superpower, right? As having a military capacity that no other country has, and that I would say most of the region suspected that Israel had, but wasn't sure, right? And especially over the course of the last year, the Israelis have actually demonstrated that they absolutely do have that capacity. And especially when you add on things like, you know, getting the KC-46s, the refueling aircraft, they really do have the ability to kind of touch everything in the region. But by the same token, you know, as I said, there are increasing numbers of folks in the region who see the United States as a rogue state. There are a lot of people who see the Israelis as a rogue state as well, right? And we should recognize that what was going on, what led in part to the Abraham Accords, was this sense that, okay, the United States is pulling back. We pulled back under Obama. We pulled back under Trump 1. We pulled back under Biden, right? That we're pulling back from the region. And there's a sense of, okay, we got to find somebody who's going to defend us, right? And they did look at China. They looked at Russia. Again, I want to come back to China. They looked at all these, and, you know, those clearly weren't going to do it. And they began thinking, you know, well, maybe the Israelis can. And of course, it was the UAE that decided to take that furthest and to say, yes, the Israelis really can be our partner. As I always like to say, if you can't get the great Satan, get the little Satan. And it's how the lines refer to us. But that was driven overwhelmingly by the sense of threat from Iran and the desire to have Israel as a protector of some kind, deterrent, defender, partner. All that's changed now. So first, they don't feel the threat from Iran is now very, very different as far as they are concerned, right? And at some level, it's greater. In others, it's less, right? They no longer are really concerned about Iran's nuclear program in a way that they absolutely were a year or so ago. And again, that was bringing them closer to the Israelis. And now what they're worried about, again, is Iran's ability to interfere with the Strait of Hormuz and Iran's ability to attack them with drones and missiles. And what they worry about is whether Israel won't help deter them fully. And again, they recognize Israel has some capacity to do so, but that Israel will provoke that, that the Israelis will start bombing the Iranians again, and the Iranians will retaliate against them as well as against Israel, right? And so they're thinking about Israel very, very differently. Everyone except the Emirates, right? The Emirates absolutely sees Israel as its future. They have been, you know, out there saying, you know, the country that most stood up for us are the Israelis. Let's also recognize the Emirates is the country that has been able to most take advantage of Israel's economic and technological capabilities. So there's that element to it as well. But for the other Gulf states, again, there's a just a different set of perspectives out there about Israel. And, you know, again, this is something that, that you and I have been thinking and talking and writing about for decades and decades, which is, you know, the Israelis once again have demonstrated that they have an absolutely magnificent tool in the IDF, but it's not clear that the IDF is the right tool for every one of Israel's strategic problems.
Yeah, well, I think another way of putting it is they're, you know, they always demonstrate remarkable tactical and operational competence, although with some very considerable failures. Strategically is very much a another story. Just on the Emirates, I'd add one other thought just from my, when I've been there, that part of the connection is they sort of think of the Israelis as an example. Small, right, technologically advanced, first world, looking to the West and to Asia, not really looking to the Arab world at all. I mean, whenever I've been there, you know, they've always made it very clear, we don't look to the north. We look to the west. We look to the south. You know, we look in some measure off to the east, to India. And of course, this fits with traditional trading patterns and all the rest. So I think that's part of it. Let's maybe use, you said you wanted to talk about China. So let me ask you to talk, you know, you've talked a lot about the United States. Talk about the other external powers and the extent to which they're going to engage. China, Russia, which I think has not played much of a role and probably can't, you may want to correct me on that. And then Turkey, which, you know, is more or less a European power, although you could also think of it as a Middle Eastern power. I mean, so talk about those three countries at least.
So let me do Russia, because I think we can do it quickly. And yes, I more or less agree with you, although, you know, it's interesting. After the 12-day war, the Russians were really, actually, I'll just put it this way. After October 7, 2023, and the 12-day war, the Russians were really on the outs in the Middle East, right? They had lost the Assad regime. They were completely bound up, you know, with their Ukrainian quagmire. They hadn't been helpful to the Iranians in the 12-day war. This war, they were actually a lot more useful, providing targeting information. They've had a little bit, a very little bit, but a little bit of a renaissance as a result of it. But yeah, they're still marginal. The Chinese are very important because, as I was suggesting beforehand, you know, if you went to the Middle East before October 7, 2023, and you spoke to leaders and elites and you talked to them about the future and the geopolitics of the region, you would have heard China nonstop, right? You get sick to your stomach of them talking about China, 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 China. China was the rising power. All, you know, China was great. China was everything that we weren't. China was going to solve all their problems. October 8th, 2023, China drops off the Middle Eastern map completely, because there is very quickly a recognition and understanding that the Chinese have no power projection capability, and they're not interested in using the tools that they actually have to do something that would actually be very costly for them, like trying to broker a peace deal. And this was always a problem that the Arab states had with the Chinese. They found the Chinese very, very transactional which is something that they didn't want. They liked the relationships with us, with the British, which were, you know, much longer term, much more strategic. Today we do this for you. Tomorrow you'll do that for us. But it's this recognition of common interests, and we work together. Chinese, you want something for us? What are you going to do for us? Right? And we'll do that one thing in return for this one thing and nothing else. Right? Add to that the fact that after the October 7 attack, it becomes very, very quickly clear the Chinese can't project power into the region. Right? And again, they've just dropped off the Middle Eastern radar. And as the Gulf states are even now trying to think about, as I said, this question of, okay, we need the Americans very much in the short term, but we're increasingly uncomfortable with the longer term strategic relationship with the United States and looking for alternatives. You know, is China an option? And increasingly their answer is no, it's not a great option for us because they can't play this role. The reason I bring it up, Elliot, is, you know, we have seen the Chinese trying to play more of a role in this conflict. I am a big believer that the reason that the Pakistanis are negotiating this is they are a stalking horse for their dear allies, the Chinese, right? But again, you know, we're going to get there eventually. I hope, I think, hell, maybe on Sunday, maybe a year from now, the Chinese will be able to claim some credit for that, but not much. And I wonder to what extent the folks in Beijing maybe rethinking this, maybe asking themselves, you know, this war was really bad for our interests and it could have been much worse. And we can't, because they have always relied, they've been the ultimate free rider, relying on us to maintain the stability of the region, ensure the free flow of oil, ensure stability generally so that they could benefit from trade. I am wondering whether this is going to be seen 20, 30 years from now as a watershed after which the Chinese decided we can't leave it to the Americans. We've got to be there. We've got to be able to project power, and we've got to be able to impose our will so that we can secure our interests.
That's a really interesting idea. I mean, that's another 1 hour, 2 hour conversation. There is one angle that I think where the Chinese have been very interesting though in this, which is, they didn't stop importing oil, but they pretty much stopped importing oil from the Middle East. It turns out they have huge oil reserves. I think people sort of knew that. One of the reasons why calamity has not occurred, despite what a lot of people predicted, at least yet, I mean, it may still be off in the horizon, is because the Chinese basically were able to draw on oil reserves that they had salted away, and so we're able to cushion. So in a weird way, you might say they were actually helpful to us by doing that. So, you know, they minimize some of the pain that we might otherwise be feeling. Okay, talk about the Turks.
Another fascinating one. So first, you asked me at the beginning to talk about MEI. So I have a phenomenal expert on Turkey at MEI, a woman by the name of Gunal Tol. And if Gunal has taught me anything, it is that all Turkish politics are local, and that understanding Erdogan is impossible if you don't understand his domestic politics. And Elliot, I'll be the first to say I am not an expert on Turkish domestic politics. So take what I have to say with a grain of salt. Okay. That said, I think that the Turks see exactly the same point that I've been making elsewhere, which is that the United States is no longer the regional hegemon that it once was. We've always been ambivalent about it. We are more ambivalent about it, and we are much more unpredictable. I think they too see the Israelis acting aggressively, I will put it that way, in a whole variety of different directions, ways that are not always conducive to winning them friends around the region, right? There's a lot of unhappiness about the Israelis. And what's more, you know, we should always remember the Turks have really expanded their own military capabilities, right? I mean, I remember, you know, 20 years ago, everybody would talk about the mighty Turkish army. And the truth is, it was all BS, right? We just didn't want to, you know, talk down about our NATO ally. But the truth is, the Turkish army was not terribly formidable, right? Now, because of the rise of drones in particular, I mean, the Bayraktars have been a sensation, right? And, you know, 2019.
It's not just that. I mean, they produce all kinds of stuff.
Exactly. Right. No question.
frigates, I mean, they have a serious military industrial complex.
Exactly. I'm just using the Bayraktars as that's the one piece that most people know about. Right? But those military capabilities and that arms industry really is enabling the Turks to kind of take part of what the United States once did. You don't have to rely on the Americans. You can get it from us. And there aren't going to be congressional restrictions. And we don't care about Israel's qualitative military edge. And, you know, in many cases, we'll sell it to you much cheaper. It may not be as good as the Americans.
But good enough.
Exactly. Be 75% as good. And, you know, if you can buy three times as many Bayraktars as you can buy whatever we are willing to sell, you know, quantity has a quality all of its own. And so I think that you're right to be focused on Turkey. We don't yet know how Erdogan is planning to play this. But over the last 5-6 years, I'd say basically since 2019, he's been pretty canny at using Turkey's independent position, arms industry, right, and willingness to partner with just about anyone except the Turks, except the Greeks, and maybe Bibi, right, both understandable, to kind of put Turkey in a very advantageous position. And yet, you have folks in the region now who are talking about the war perhaps creating a fissure across America's allies in the region, where you've got the Israelis and the Emirates and to some extent the Indians on one side, and another axis led by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt on the other, which, you know, I'll say to you, that's not good for the United States, but that's very good for the Turks.
Fascinating. I've got two more big questions for you. So the first big question is, we remember the Arab Spring. I remember you and I talking a lot about it. Is this really the beginning of something big and new and different or not? You know, it seems we've gone, and it ended up with a lot of bloodshed and misery and a lot of broken hopes on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, you've had another wave. I think people were impressed by Saudi modernization, I mean, which is clearly for real, though there are a lot of dark, very dark sides to the Saudi regime. You know, there was clearly part of the result of the wars that followed after October 7th, 2023, were what looked like the collapse of Hezbollah, except it's not the collapse because they're clearly still around, but certainly the collapse of the Assad regime. Iraq, I think, is the story that people don't talk about. It's, you know, getting along. It's not, you know, it is not, in that respect, not the failure that I think everybody has always assumed that it was. You know, you can argue that the war was unnecessary. You can argue that the war was too costly. You can argue that the follow through was very badly handled, which, you know, tends to be my view of it. But on the whole, you know, the Iraqi regime that you have in place now is a lot better than what we had before. You know, and there is modernization going on. So do you have any general observations on the Middle East, particularly from the point of view of internal politics, and call it what you will, liberalization, democratization, modernization, however you choose to characterize it?
So, I mean, first, this probably, you know, sounds obvious, but I think it's worth saying, which is that, you know, the Arab Spring was such a huge event that you have to see it as being part of some very long-term trends, right? And I saw it as, in many ways, kind of not quite an end point, but a transition point from the industrial age of the Arab world into the information age, right? And I put it this way, the Industrial Revolution more or less skipped the Middle East, right? Certainly skipped the Muslim Middle East. And as a result, they were not beneficiaries of it. And, you know, they developed a state system after World War II, autocracy coupled with these rentier economies, largely dependent on oil in one way, shape, or form, either direct or indirect, and very, very conservative social systems that were designed to not rock the boat so that you didn't have movement against it. Right? And this all kind of worked well for the Arab elites, never great for the people, kind of clunked along. The governments would use, you know, pan-Arabism, decolonization, the war against Israel to kind of excuse a lot of things. And by the early 2000s, right, that model was on life support. I mean, life support was a nice way of saying it. It was falling apart. And the Arab Spring was, you know, that system starting to come apart at the seams, right? It could easily have done so. But a few things come out of that. First, it comes at the start of the information revolution. And exactly as you pointed out, you know, what we've seen with the information revolution is that isn't skipping the Muslim Middle East. As you pointed out, I teach at Georgetown. I teach for the U.S. government. I teach for the Alexander Hamilton Society. I teach for lots of places. And, you know, I always like to ask my students, you know, how many of you have a smartphone? They all do. And my answer is great. How many of you can repair your smartphone? And of course, the answer is none, right? I said, good. So you're now on a par with the Arabs. And by the way, they all have two smartphones. So they're actually ahead of you, right? So, you know, the advantages that the West had in terms of its understanding of industrial technology and ability to employ it, that's kind of falling by the wayside. We can talk about that militarily if you want to. You know, I've done a lot of work on it. But just here economically, it's creating opportunities in the Arab world that you didn't see during the industrial age. And I think, you know, what came out of the Arab Spring was two things. First, a sense that the revolutions were very, very dangerous because they led either to civil war, right, in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, create civil war, or Islamist, the threat at least of Islamist dictatorship, which in places like Egypt and Tunisia, everybody said, you know what, Islamist dominance through a democratic system, where people suddenly decided, we don't want that either, right? And so on the one hand, everyone decided, okay, we don't really want to overthrow the government, plus there's now hope, right? It's a new world. There's the prospect of something better. And as you point out, a lot of the Arab governments coming out of the Arab Spring said, you know what? The people are really unhappy. We better start reforming. And it doesn't take a lot of hope to get people to say, you know what? Let's give these guys a try. The world is changing. The information age is revolutionizing our economy. The government is doing some different things. Let's see what happens. I think the one great danger out there is the Gulf is all hooked up for taking full advantage of the information revolution, right? The Emirates, the Qataris, the Saudis, they are going to follow AI into the stratosphere. If they take the rest of the region with them, I think this could be a very good outcome. I think the real danger is if the Egyptians and the Algerians and the Jordanians and the Syrians feel completely left behind, like the Gulf states left them all behind. I agree with you about the Israelis and Emiratis, because you're right. Both Israel and the Emirates wanted to kind of divorce themselves from the Middle East and be Western countries. If that's what happens with the Gulf states and the bigger countries, let's remember, Egypt is a quarter of the Arab world's population, right? You throw in Algeria, I mean, you're talking about most of the Arab world. If they get left behind, that could create some very, very unhappy people. And it's just unpredictable at that point.
That's so interesting. And I mean, again, we could go on for hours. The thoughts suddenly occurred to me. We've taken Egyptian stability for granted ever since General Sisi took over. Well, who knows if that's really forever true. The other thought that occurred to me, there's a little bit of the thing about the Arab Spring, some resemblances to 1848 in Europe, where you have the set of, you know, upheavals, revolts, they get put down or collapse in one way or the other. But there's a similar sort of pattern where the governments say, okay, we better extend suffrage, we better begin creating social security kinds of, you know, safety nets and things of that kind. All right, last question. So every president that I'm aware of has wanted to get the hell out of the Middle East. I mean, I remember Don Rumsfeld, beginning of the George W. Bush administration. Now we're going to pivot to China. For sure, Barack Obama wanted to get the hell out of the Middle East. For sure, Donald Trump wanted to get the hell out of the Middle East. You know, Joe Biden wanted to get the hell out of the Middle East. And there we are. And we're still stuck there. What? what's going, I mean, is the answer just simply oil? Okay, and just say, you know, oil matters. But why, even there you go, well, wait a second, we're now the world's biggest exporter of the stuff. So why? So explain in the remaining couple of minutes why we try to well, it's easy to understand why we want to disentangle ourselves from a place where, you know, we get into wars that we seem to screw up a lot. Why can't we extricate ourselves? And why do we screw up as much as at least I think we screw up? And I suspect you probably agree.
Absolutely. Boy, that's a big one. So let me see if I can do this in something of a nutshell. So first, why do we care about the region? It's a combination of the oil and then, of course, the old line that the Middle East is not Las Vegas, that what happens there doesn't stay there, right? And it has a very bad habit of spilling over into all kinds of countries. And just to pick up on that point, you know, when Syria fell into civil war, I had done a whole bunch of work on countries in civil war and spillover because I'd been looking at the Iraqi civil war and how bad that could be. And as I applied those same lessons to Syria, I said, you know, if this gets really bad, it could affect Europe. And I remember I was literally writing a piece on this. I said, do I put that in the piece? No, everybody's going to think I'm a crazy alarmist.
And it did.
But exactly. I would never have been able to predict that it would ultimately be the causal element of Brexit, right? I mean, who the hell would have thought of that? But that's that problem. Back to the oil. So, I mean, you're right. We are the largest producer in the world of oil. And we do, this is tricky, we are a net exporter of oil. But what people don't understand is that's not about how much we produce versus how much we consume. That's about different kinds of oil produced in different places and what's cheapest and what's gains the best profit. The simple fact of the matter is the United States produces 13.4 million barrels per day, but we consume 19.1 million barrels per day. So we are a net importer of oil ultimately. Makes us dependent on the world. We do have reserves, so we've been doing okay since then. But we also have to recognize, even beyond that, our economy is also tied to the economies of the rest of the world. And so if, you know, there were a massive oil shortage, right, even worse than what we've got, right, let's imagine Saudi Arabia falls into revolution and we lose all of Saudi oil. So there's a loss of, you know, 10, 11 million barrels, not the 5 to 7 that we're actually losing now, right? We, even if we kind of shut off the rest of the world and rely on our reserves as well as our own production, because of all our trade partners will tank, right? Our economy will tank because of that just a little bit later on. So we can't walk away from the Middle East. We can't just divorce ourselves from it. Certainly not before we've weaned the entire global economy off of oil, which would be a great thing, right? As a Middle East expert, there's no one who would like us to be less reliant on the Middle East than me. But that doesn't seem likely. Next point to make. You know, you're absolutely right. I've been in Washington. Boy, I came down here during the Reagan administration. And every single administration I've either worked for or advised or simply kibitzed from the outside, they've all started out saying, we want to do less in the Middle East, right? And we're determined to do less in the Middle East. And yes, we have been pivoting toward Asia for decades, right? And let's recognize initially, I mean, especially the Obama administration, they weren't actually serious about pivoting to Asia. They were just trying to come up with an excuse to do less in the Middle East. And what I've consistently said to them is that is a mistake, because if you disengage from the Middle East, the pot is going to boil over and it's going to wreck everything else. The smart thing to do is start out by engaging with the region, right? If you start to address its problems early on, you can do so at low cost and put it in a place where it's not going to be a problem for you later on. But we never are willing to do that. Right. Because we always look at those costs and say, well, that's more than we're paying now. So I don't want to pay that, not recognizing that if you don't do that, you pay 10 times the cost later on.
Very last question. So why do we screw up as badly as we screw up? Or do you think maybe we don't screw up as much as we criticize ourselves for screwing up?
So, yeah, it's a great question. Again, try to give a relatively brief answer. So we screw up a lot. We don't screw up as much as I think most people think. I mean, I can point, I know you can as well, to real successes that the United States has had. Although, you know, even our successes typically come with some dark lining, just as many of our failures come with a silver lining, right? It's never black or white, and we should always recognize that. Why do we? And, you know, as you know, I've got a new book coming out, not too distant future, on the U.S. and Iraq, the whole relationship. And the last chapter of that book is some lessons. And some of the lessons I had to say about Iraq, I think, are applicable more generally toward the Middle East. And I'll just name two of them. One of them is that we always try to do as little as we possibly can, right? What is the least I can do to try to deal with the problems of the Middle East, to just kind of keep them from boiling over until I'm out of office? And it never works, right? We always get it wrong. And again, this, in part, this gets back to my earlier point about how process matters far more than the idea as conceived. But another piece of it is, you know, I increasingly believe, Elliot, that it's really hard to find true Goldilocks solutions in human experience. That in point of fact, you either get benevolent cycles or vicious cycles. And if you do things right and commit enough resources and make the effort, you get a benevolent cycle where everything works. And if you don't, you get a vicious cycle. And the problem is, of course, that when you get the benevolent cycle, people come out of it saying, well, we didn't have to invest as much as we did. We could have done it with less. And when you get the vicious cycle, people come out of it saying it was always a lost cause and we never should have. I think both of those are wrong. And the other one is something that you alluded to earlier, but it's a huge problem for us, which is the problem of mirror imaging. Right. We constantly look at, you know, at some level, it's part of the American psyche, right? It's American culture. We teach our kids from the time, you know, they can stand upright to put yourself in the other person's shoes. And the problem is when we do that, we bring our values, our history, our goals, our perspectives to the other person's vantage point. And typically they don't share our values, our history, our goals, our perspectives. And, you know, I think a perfect example of that has been Donald Trump's experience where, you know, he has a bunch of, and to me, it's very familiar. Many of my parents' friends were also folks who made lots of money in New York. I wish I had, you know, perhaps I should have followed them, but, you know, and had the same kinds of ideas. We should take their oil. I can remember any number of times, you know, it's kind of like, that's not the way it's going to work. That is not a good idea. And the more that we assume that they're going to behave the way that we would in their position, the more we get ourselves into trouble.
Ken, this is terrific. What's the title of the book and when can we expect to read it?
It is called The Iraq Wars, and it will be out in February of next year.
Well, we will definitely have you on when when the book is out. Everybody should go out and buy it. But hopefully we'll get you before then. Really, thank you. This has been a terrific conversation.
My pleasure. So great to be on with you, Elliot, always. Thank you.